Spirit Radio Podcasts.
Across the country tomorrow, you're going to see numerous cathedrals and churches illuminated red to mark Red Wednesday. Now, this is really all about showing solidarity with suffering Christians around the world, those who are persecuted for their faith. And I think when we think of that sign, that symbol, it's something probably many of us take for granted, that we can freely practice our faith here in Ireland without fear of being persecuted. On the line to tell us more about Red Wednesday, we've John Pontifex, who's head of press and information at Aid to the Church in New. John, good morning to you.
Good morning, Wendy.
So tell us a little bit about Red Wednesday and why you decided to start it. What's the background to it all?
Well, obviously at Aid to the Church in Need, we receive daily reports of those who suffer for their faith. I mean, we think particularly at this time, obviously, of Asia Bibi. She's been acquitted and now is apparently a free woman, but in actual fact, she is not free. She's held in protective custody, and the prospects for her eventual freedom seem to be as far as ever. And we're hoping very much that she will obtain that freedom. But it's still not arrived. And she's one of many, many people around the world who, simply for the fact of being Christian, suffer for their faith. And we felt that there was a wonderful way in which we could all gather around in prayer and in solidarity around this colour of red. Red, the colour of martyrdom. Red, the colour of the Passion of the Christ, Good Friday, etc. And so coming together by wearing red, be it a red tie, a red scarf, be it lighting up your church or cathedral red, be it by posting something with a red motif on social media, all these are wonderful ways to stand in solidarity with those who suffer for their faith, and making everyone aware that this is a human rights catastrophe, that there should be so much persecution. And we mentioned this not least because we at Aid to the Church Need have recently produced our Religious Freedom in the World report that indicates that the severity of persecution, not least of Christians, is as bad as it's ever been.
Is it getting worse, John?
The evidence suggests that in the countries where the situation is particularly egregious and serious, yes, the situation is getting worse. 18 out of the 38 countries listed in our report as being of greatest concern, in those 18 countries, we've seen the situation declining. And there seems to be many countries as well, in addition to that, where the situation is already so bad, it could scarcely get any worse.
In terms of then some of the buildings in Ireland and in the UK, is there many that will be marking Red Wednesday?
Yes. Across the country, we know that there are churches, cathedrals that are going red, and messages of support are coming in from others too, which are making that decision belatedly to go red. And, for example, we're delighted that in Scotland we've got churches and cathedrals going red, and also across the UK, and indeed in Ireland as well. The island of Ireland as a whole is marking this tremendous event by going red in a very, very special way. And we're hoping very, very much that it'll be a sign that all of us are willing to stand together in the face of persecution, and recognizing that we each share in this great desire to bring freedom for those whose only wish is to practice their faith in freedom and in due conscience.
Do you think, John, that most people are aware of the level of Christian persecution around the world? I mean, you mentioned Asia Bibi just there, and that's probably one of very few cases that's actually been reported on in the mainstream media. But for so many cases and so much of the persecution happening in countries around the world, certainly people in Ireland wouldn't know about it because it's not talked about.
This is a really important point, actually, Wendy. In fact, in our Religious Freedom in the World report, we identify how religious freedom has actually disappeared down the human rights priority rankings. It's well and truly trumped by issues including gender, including race, including disability, including sexuality. Now, the point here is that these things are not unimportant. Of course, they are important. But when we're faced with other situations where people are targeted specifically for their faith, practiced in due respect of the law and due respect for the rights of others, what our sense is that those people who suffer in that way are not given the attention and due respect that they are entitled to. And Red Wednesday is about standing up for them, standing beside them, praying alongside them, and recognizing that through our faith we share in a very special way in their suffering and in their great aspiration to be people free and able to express their faith openly and with conscience.
I presume, John, one of the hopes as well as just having awareness just among average ordinary citizens is also to highlight and keep raising awareness amongst our governments as well.
Yes, and again, that was borne out in the Religious Freedom in the World report, where we indicated that in truth, yes, governments have a stated wish and commitment to stand up for religious freedom. But in actual fact, the question needs to be asked, to what extent are they actually delivering on that stated commitment? Too often, the sense is that Christians and other faith groups are suffering precisely because the governments are not actually delivering on this commitment. And just to give an example of that, if you look at what happened in Iraq, where you had 120,000 Christians forced out of the Nineveh Plains in northern Iraq by Daesh, when eventually Daesh was forced out, the prospect for those Christians to go back to their ancient homelands in biblical Nineveh was very much hampered by government dithering, in effect, as to whether to offer them support. Now, that support is now beginning to come through. But the sense we had early on in that process of rehabilitation, of enabling these people to go back, was that the governments were very, very uncertain about whether or not to step forward with that. And we also see in the case of Asia Bibi, there have been lots of concerns about whether countries, including the UK, should be actually offering asylum. Yes, they're willing to support other countries offering asylum, but the question is whether the UK, for example, should itself offer asylum. And when we launched the report of the last week in the Houses of Parliament, we sensed the huge amount of anxiety amongst parliamentarians and others that the government hadn't actually offered asylum. So this question of whether they're actually making good their promises with regard to religious freedom is one that very much it needs to be answered. And we hope that by coming together and by wearing red, shining red, posting red, what we're doing is making a clear statement that enough is enough and that we must stand together in faith and in freedom.
It's interesting, John, that you just mentioned that experience last week just talking to politicians. Is that what we need to continue to do, is to continue to put political pressure on those who represent us? Because obviously individuals, certainly, I'm sure it's the same in the UK, here in Ireland, can contact their local representative and say, you need to do more on this. You need to do whatever you can.
Yes. There's a two-pronged approach. The first is the one, indeed, that you identify very clearly and very rightly, which is to engage with politicians. The other is to support the work of organisations, not least aid to the Church Need, who are delivering on the need to support those who are persecuted and oppressed. So, for example, if we go back to that that case of Iraq, where you have the rebuilding of homes shattered by Daesh, and which are now being brought back to life with Christians going back, that process is urgently in need of support. And we think of, for example, in Egypt, where that pilgrim bus was on its way on pilgrimage and was targeted in almost exactly the same spot as where a previous bus was targeted. So again, Aid to the Church Need is supporting churches, supporting catechists, supporting priests in training, supporting sisters, and supporting those wanting Christian education. If we believe in religious freedom, we need to lend support in material ways to those who sorely need our help to be able to express that religious freedom and to express their faith in a way that makes them feel that they are giving due respect to their Lord and Saviour.
John, thanks so much for joining us on the programme today. And please God, Red Wednesday will do what you are hoping it to do, to raise awareness both for individuals and also on a political level as well, and remind us, as you said, for us to pray for persecuted Christians around the world. That's John Pontifex, who's Head of Press and Information at Aid to the Church in Need. You can get more information on acnireland.org. And as John said, remember to go red tomorrow. Wear red, tweet red, hashtag Red Wednesday. Do all that you can to be part of Red Wednesday and highlight the persecution of Christians around the world. Well, something that has been in the headlines many times over the last number of years is the rising childcare costs and just parents struggling to try and achieve that balance between working and also childcare. And I mean, I remember a headline not so long ago where it was talking about the cost of childcare adding up to another mortgage. So I would imagine many parents who have their children in a creche facility or an early years facility were shocked when there was a headline last week which said that 11 children had been reported as missing from one of these facilities, according to an early years inspectorate annual report. But as with all reports, what's important is to make sure that we delve down into the whole report and get the full picture as to of some of the findings of it. And to help us do that, we have Frances Byrne, who's the Director of Policy and Advocacy at Early Childhood Ireland. Good morning, Frances. How are you?
Morning, Wendy.
So tell us a little bit about this report that TUSLA does. So this is where they do kind of random inspections of early years facilities, or how does it work?
Well, no, they do inspections every year, but what they do on an annual basis then is do a random report. So they have an analysis of 500 randomly selected non-compliant regulations across the board. So it's a snapshot of the almost 5,000 early year services that are registered. So there were about 4,507, I think, 4484 in 2017, and this would just look, as I said, randomly at a sample of them. So you would have in some parts of the country, for example, in outside the kind of Dublin Mid-Leinster area, you'd have very few services actually involved in this, and it's not deliberate, it's just the way they're randomly pulled. So there's no, I suppose, there's no analysis done based on we're going to make sure we have X number of Cork to reflect the numbers in Cork or the numbers in Dublin, if you see what I mean. But given that the majority of creches are in the Dublin Mid-Leinster area, it's no surprise that the majority of regulation breaches, as well as positive things that have happened, are in that area. But it doesn't mean that in the rest of the country that provision is poor. I think it's important to say that. So there's great information in the report, and I suppose there are positives in the report. There are worrying things, as you have said, Wendy, but there's just some caution, and TUSLA themselves would say this, because it's a random, it's not, if you like, independent researchers going in, taking the TUSLA inspection reports, looking across the sector and saying there are X many full daycare, we'll make sure we have a similar percentage in this report. So it's just important to say that. Every year we sort of bring up this issue that, you know, it's randomly done. Now, that's not to dismiss it all. It is useful to have this information collated on an annual basis.
And do you think, Frances, just in terms of, and I was looking just on the report just about just the numbers of facilities that have opened, and obviously there's a lot more demand for these types of facilities for early childhood care and creches and all that sort of stuff. So do we actually have the capacity? I know one of reading the list as a mom, when I'm reading the list of the various different kind of injuries that happened, you know, there's some that I'm looking at them going, jeepers, yeah, that could happen in my house when I'm one and one watching my child. But obviously, there, you know. But then there's others that you're reading them, like a child's hand being pierced with an EpiPen, and various different things that you kind of read and say. I was doing a paediatric first aid course last week, and I know one of the things that a lady there who ran a play school said, we don't allow marshmallows in our play school, and I know one of the things was a child choking on a piece of marshmallow. So, in other words, is there, because there's been such an increase and there's such a demand, is there enough capacity there to be able to do full inspections and things like that, like practical, making sure that there's practical first aid training for all staff and all that sort of stuff?
No, I mean, certainly there's a recognition across the board, and you've heard me say this before, there's serious underinvestment in the sector, and indeed Every creche in the country won't receive an annual inspection. Sometimes it'll be every second year. Now, if parents complain, TUSLA will act, and it's important to say that if there are parents listening who have concerns, TUSLA will act on that. And certainly if there are serious child protection concerns, we would be saying ring TUSLA and then ring the guards if they're immediate, of course. But the capacity issue is a really interesting one. So I suppose there's two sides to the capacity issue. There's the piece about the staff recruitment and retention and indeed training that you're sort of referring to there. And then there's the capacity, and certainly Dublin listeners will say, you know, I've had my child on a waiting list since they were born. I've had my child on a waiting list since I was pregnant. So there are definitely various capacity issues and unfortunately underpinned by underinvestment. So certainly there aren't enough TUSLA inspectors. Now, to be fair to TUSLA, they had a recent recruitment drive. They've also produced a very important quality framework for the sector and are saying in advance which parts of it they're going to be prioritising. It's interesting that you're mentioning first aid, because there is first aid training being made available across the board in terms of staffing in creches. So, you know, capacity is a really interesting angle to take on this. We know that in Ireland, whether it's on inspection, whether it's on staffing, whether it's on provision, we are not, we haven't invested enough, and we certainly need to do that, and that will in turn affect capacity, and it particularly affects anybody who's trying to go back to work after having a baby will tell you how difficult it is to try and find a creche that has what's become known as baby rooms. It's really difficult for children under three. I think for children over three, the ECHI scheme is there, the free preschool year as it's known. And there's a lot more provision. Indeed, there are creches across the country that are only taking in children on the so-called free preschool year. And they would be the majority. And I suppose it's a bit worrying that we also see that they're growing when we need to see provision for younger children coming in. So, the capacity issue, as I said, is very broad.
It's interesting that you're just mentioning, Frances, there are children under three. And I know in the TUSLA report, it says that those services that were providing full daycare were most likely to be non-compliant. It makes sense in terms of obviously they have children for longer hours and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But I'm kind of connecting the dots there and joining it up with the strategy that the government released last week, I think it was a week or two ago, called First Five, which was looking at the first 5 years of a child's life. And one of the things that report cautioned against was long hours, and they qualified that as over 32 hours. Now, if you're working full time and your baby or child is in a creche, it's going to be over 32 hours. So do we need to be doing more to, yes, resource the facilities that are there, but also say, you know, is the right solution, especially for younger children? I know the parental leave is getting a bit better and we're getting closer to that year, but the kind of 1 to 3 years, or 0 to 3, I should say, are really, really important in terms of being with a primary carer rather than maybe in creches for long hours. Do you think there's been enough done to try and look at that?
Yeah, I mean, what we've been saying in our Early Childhood Ireland is that we need to be moving, and to be quite frank, much more rapidly than I think the government has in mind, to a full year of either mum or dad at home in a two-parent scenario, mum or dad in a one-parent, obviously. And that's really important. Now, I think that it's also important to immediately add, there are, of course, families where that won't work because you could have two self-employed parents. You could have a scenario where there are, you know, individual cases of, be it ongoing mental health challenges, addiction challenges, or indeed postpartum issues that arise for people. So we do need to consider the diversity of families. However, for the most part, we should be moving towards what the government has committed to sort of by the end of its term, that it will be moving towards a full year. And it also needs to be properly compensated, because we know that a lot of dads don't take it up, even though they get 2 weeks at the moment, about to be 4 weeks next year. And the reason they give is, we can't afford it. It's an extremely expensive time for any family.
And if you've got mum and dad both just getting the state benefit and wherever they work isn't paying them their salary, well, then
exactly.
That's a big hit.
If you're not being paid the top up, you're basically being thrust into poverty. So we can't have that either. The European Commission has recommended that states move towards 66% of salary, which certainly the evidence is that keeps people above the poverty line. Now, they're absolutely not making money off that, but at least they're not slipping into poverty, because nobody wants that either. It's very bad for children and families. Then absolutely there needs to be, you know, a mix of care and education, depending on the individual family, the individual child. And that's certainly something that Early Childhood Ireland would like to see a big public discussion and debate about in Ireland, because we're historically
just kind of more support for different options, whether it's creche or childminder
or mum and dad,
and I suppose, granny or
Yeah, and one of the concerning things, Wendy, from this report, from the latest Tootle inspection reports, and indeed from all the evidence that we can see online, is that very, very few childminders, who are a very important part of the picture, very few of them are registering. And we really need measures to address that, be it encouraging them, incentivizing them, and also providing training for them.
So
nobody
they need the same thing. They need the first aid training that we touched
exactly.
on there, and all the sort
they
of
need,
checks and balances.
Exactly.
And I think most parents would want that.
Exactly. And they need to be Garda vetted, like our members are now. We are not remotely suggesting that they're subject to any kind of the registration levels that our members are, because, you know, it's a completely different scenario. You're going into someone's house. But, you know, the government has estimated there are about 35,000 childminders, and there are fewer than 150 registered with Tootle, and that's quite worrying. And that's not to cast aspersions on anybody, but it's important that we know where children are.
Do you think, Frances, something that would help with that is that obviously at the moment, unless you're registered, I know they're trying to encourage that, because I think if the childminder is registered, but they have to have a certain number of children for them, for you to be able to use the government subsidy. So does that need to be looked at, where that's a bit broader, that government subsidy that is mostly going to children who are in creche care, that it's easier for those who are using a childminder to actually take that and use that for their childminder then?
Yeah, and they certainly can. Provided the childminder is registered. Now, to be very clear, because of all the controversy over the summer, nobody is talking about grannies and granddads and uncles and aunties and other people who mind children. This is what's called non-kinship childminders. It's really important. Now, the first five strategy that, as you say, was launched last week does mention this and does say that there will be actions. But that's really important, because apart from anything else, there aren't enough creche places in the country. And as you have said, it won't suit every child and family situation. There's lots of reasons why it won't. Whether you for younger or older children, there can be reasons to do with school transport. There can be all kinds of reasons. So childminders are very much in the mix, and we need to be bringing them into the net and consulting them and talking to them about what would you like, what would work in terms of the kind of training. You know, there's certainly evidence. I know there was some surveying done of childminders that they'd absolutely love to be networking with each other and receiving training. So that's a very important part of the mix as well, and to bring those families in. And as you say, so they can receive the same subsidies as parents who use our members' settings get to use as well. And from next year, those subsidies are due to increase. So it's really important that all families are able to avail of them.
Just finally to ask you, Frances, just for parents who maybe saw some of the headlines last week, or they're listening to some of the things contained in that Tootle report, and maybe their child is in a creche and they're kind of worried now, because you don't want to scaremonger parents either.
No,
you know, it's
not.
Very important for us to be vigilant for the inspections to be done and to increasingly make sure that standards are adhered to. But what would your advice be to a parent who thinks, gosh, I don't like what I'm reading, what should I do in terms of, like, there could be absolutely no problem where their child is, but what do parents do in this situation if they are worried?
Of course. Well, the first thing they should do is go in and talk to the manager and or the staff member who they should be on first name terms with, if their child is maybe your child is there for a while, and have a chat and talk about their concerns. And I would just say to any parents or prospective parents listening, you know, always trust your gut. Even if you can't name why you like or don't like a place, it's obviously ticking the boxes for you. You know, it's speaking to your values, whatever it might be that you just like. You like the feel of it. Go with that. Similarly, if you don't like it, even if you can't name why you don't like it, you know, try not to feel pressurized. Give yourself plenty of time to choose somewhere that you know, you know, you have a good feeling about. You'll be happy going in and out of. And absolutely, if you have concerns, you know, even if they're niggling at you and you can't exactly name it, go and talk it through with the creche manager. All of our members would absolutely be up for that. They work hard to involve parents, and even though they're out the door with work themselves, they're always glad to see parents coming in and totally open to hearing feedback or concerns And that's as it should be. It's very important that parents feel comfortable with the choices they're making. So, you know, I would say don't hesitate. If you have a concern, even if it's based on the report, even if, you know, you've nothing to connect what you've read with the creche that your child is in, what we'd be saying in Early Childhood Ireland is don't hesitate. Go in, make the appointment or drop in, whatever the way things are done in the creche, and ask to have a chat. And hopefully you'll feel much better after doing that.
Thanks so much for chatting to us this morning. That's Frances Byrne there from Early Childhood Ireland. And she was talking about the TUSLA Early Years Inspectorate annual report. If you want to get that report, by the way, it is on the TUSLA website if you do want to read it. We've been talking to our relationships coach, Catherine Gray, about the seven deadly relationship sins. These are relevant, of course, to single people who are looking to find a long-term partner. But I think a lot of these things are relevant to all of us, and not just our romantic relationships. Often they can be about our friendships as well. But last week we were talking about being self-centred and talking about, you know, how oftentimes out of nervousness that we end up talking about ourselves. And today we're going to be talking about having a checklist for Mr. or Mrs. Right. And I think we kind of, especially with the online world and a lot of online dating, people are sadly encouraged to look at others. It's like an online supermarket, isn't it? Of the things you want and don't want. But have we got our priorities all wrong? Well, Catherine reckons so. Catherine Gray, Director of Heavenly Partners, joins me on the line. Morning, Catherine. How are you?
Good morning, Wendy. Very well. Thank you. Very well.
So in terms of today's sin, which is all about, as I said, having that checklist, I think some of us do it consciously. Some of us do it subconsciously. We mightn't even know the reason that we are dismissing someone is because they're not ticking a box. In your experience, is it becoming more common that people kind of sit down and say, I want this, this, this and this?
I think it's absolutely common, and I think it's something that we all do. I think it's a very, very human trait to go around with a checklist in your head, and it's often very subconscious. I know I personally absolutely fell foul of this. When I met my now absolutely amazing husband, he definitely didn't fit the perfect criteria in any shape or form. I wanted somebody that was sporty, that was young, that had never been married before, that didn't have children, that was not that much older than me. He didn't really share any characteristics, apart from the fact that he was a fellow Catholic. He didn't share any of the same characteristics or any of the things that were on my list. And I did my utmost to get rid of him, actually, and I did dump him once or twice. And I am incredibly grateful now because we have the most amazing marriage. He's the most wonderful, wonderful husband. And all the characteristics that he has got are things that I really, really need. And all the things that I thought I needed weren't really so important. So sometimes we have this list in our heads, but it's actually not the right list for us. But there's almost no way of getting out of that that dilemma.
A lot of the time it's kind of superficial stuff, and you do often hear maybe it's a friend or family member that's very, very brutally honest, where they might say something like, you're always going for the same type. And by type, that could be how the person looks or personality traits that don't actually suit you. So in other words, we might actually have this list, whether it's conscious or subconscious, but as you say, it's got all the wrong things on it, and that could be one of the reasons things aren't working out.
And that's absolutely right. I think the thing, Wendy, about all these deadly relationship sins are it's about opening your eyes. It's about realizing there are lots and lots of people out there. But when you have this list, you sort of close yourself down. So perhaps, you know, if there are 10 men in a room and you're looking for somebody that's sporty and 9 of them are not sporty, you think, oh, there's only one person to meet here. That's a bit of a ridiculous example, but it's a good one in some ways. You think, oh, I want to meet somebody sporty. None of these guys are sporty. They're all unfit. They're all couch potatoes. Therefore, there's nobody here. They go around saying, oh, I went to this party and there was absolutely not a single person that was right for me. Whereas in fact, if you actually spend a bit of time saying, well, okay, I thought I wanted somebody sporty, but actually I'm going to open my eyes to all of these people and I'm going to allow myself to get to know them based on not having that as a criteria, it's amazing what you might find and actually discover that there are a lot more people available to be considered as a date than you initially thought.
In terms of then people kind of actually thinking about this, because like the other sins we talked about, Catherine, it's about self-awareness. And obviously people might have done, I was mentioning there, I remember when I did the online dating thing, and I did, it felt like this online supermarket where you really like had to tick all these boxes of things that you wanted and didn't want. But often, of course, they're very superficial things. Is the first step kind of self-awareness and saying, okay, here's the things I think I want, but what is actually important?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I was reading a fantastic book the other day that was saying, like I'm saying, chuck away your list completely and just look for somebody wonderful. I mean, that is your criteria to say to all your friends, not I'm looking for somebody sporty or somebody who's 5'8" or somebody who's, you know, into this or into that, or but just to say I'm looking for somebody wonderful, and that to be your only criteria, because actually then you can't really judge somebody on meeting them initially. You can't say, oh, well, he's not sporty, or he doesn't go to this particular church, or he doesn't do this particular job, because you've actually got to know them. You've got to get to know them to find out if they're wonderful or not. So it's about saying, you know, chuck your list. And be open to everybody that you could possibly meet, and tell, and don't sort of shut yourself down by saying, oh, you've got to be X, Y, and Z. And I think on the, if you are using a sort of an online dating site, and not something sort of as personal as Heavenly Partners, then it's trying to make your criteria as absolutely limited as possible, and keep your search criteria as wide as possible, so that you can be introduced to as many people as possible. That's the important thing here.
Is there ever a situation where there's kind of two types of lists, and by that I mean the things like the sporty or the this height or that, you know, things that A, can change, and B, aren't really part of the core character. But is there other things that actually you should put down as being important that could be having similar values on certain things?
Well, absolutely. I mean, Heavenly Partners is all about helping people get together with other people who share their Christian faith. Now, for us, for me personally, and for the organisation that I run, that's an absolute given. That's the one thing that I wouldn't compromise on at all. So going back to my husband, I mean, that is the thing we shared. We both had this Christian faith. He was a Catholic. I was a sort of lapsed Catholic, but a very practicing Christian. That was the one thing I wasn't prepared to compromise on at all. And yes, I suppose there are some, you know, some values for some people. It'll be kindness or generosity, or whether they're loving, or how they interact with other people. And I think those sort of values are incredibly important, because if you don't share those values, and for me, the Christian value was the most important one, then you're pretty much off to a bad start. Now, some people would say, oh, well, I'm off to a bad start if he doesn't share my love of football, or I'm off to a bad start if he's taller than me. But really, those sort of things are pretty irrelevant. And even the big one, looks. I mean, I know looks are really, really important for many people, and particularly younger people. They think looks are so important. But actually, we are a big believer that looks change. And actually, when somebody's character comes through, your view of that person and their looks change as well. I mean, one of the great examples I had of somebody where we persuaded her to ditch her list, because on her list was they've got to be reasonably good looking. And this was a lovely, lovely lady that we worked with. And we said to her, okay, just let's widen your list a bit. Let's not consider people based on their looks first and foremost. And she ended up marrying this lovely man called Ted. And she said to us afterwards, when I first saw his photograph, I was absolutely not interested in going anywhere. But then I took note of what you'd said, Catherine. I decided I'd meet him. And if we could have got married the very next day, because I completely fell for him, his character was amazing. And she did end up marrying him. And I'm sure, you know, he's not the best looking man in the world, probably. But there's so many other things that were right for her.
It's a really good example, and I think it's something that I would be a big advocate of the reality that you might meet someone initially, they might be your type, you know, and then as you get to know them, you can fall in love with them and the chemistry grows. And equally, I've had experiences, Catherine, over the years where you meet someone who's absolutely, you know, drop dead gorgeous, and then you get to know them, and because you don't like their character or they're not very nice people, that attraction fades very, very quickly.
Oh, that's so true. That's so true. And the other thing, Wendy, that's particularly important is geography, where people live. And we have so many people who say, oh, I don't want to meet him, or I don't want to meet her, because they live 2, 3, 4, 5 hours away. But again, we've got a lovely example of Dorothy. She was living in Chester, and she was contacted by a man living in County Armagh. And her initial reaction was, oh, I'm quite elderly and he's a long way away. And actually we said to her, but if he was the right man, wouldn't that be wonderful? And incredibly, because it's normally, incredibly, they did meet and she moved to be with him. Now, it's often the other way around. Often the man moves to be with the woman. But again, if she hadn't been able to ditch her list about the man's got to live within an hour of me, she'd still be on her own now. So that's another big criteria that's well worth thinking about. So what a very difficult one to get over, but it's a very important one.
And that's
one
the
too.
Thing, that was my next question, leading into it nicely, Catherine, is, so you've convinced someone to say, okay, I'll try and shorten the checklist or throw away most of it, but there's some things that I'm just finding really hard to get over. What's your advice there?
Well, I'd need to know what the thing that is really hard to get over. And I would say the fact that you are really aware of it is a really good thing. And then to say, okay, so supposing it's the distance, you absolutely can't move. Then I say to people, if that is a criteria that's set in stone, you've thought about it, and I've even said to you, right, I've got this perfect, perfect man. I'm looking into a crystal ball that I don't have, but I'm looking to the future, and you're with him, and you're so, so happy. Now tell me, would you rather not have that happiness in the future and stick to that criteria? And actually, when you put it like that, most people go, if you really could promise me it was perfect and I was going to be really happy with him, then yes, I'd ditch the criteria. And some people say, do you know what? No, my family or my ties in this particular place are so, so, so important. I'd rather stick with those than have to move and be with somebody. And then that's your answer, really. But often when you do portray it like that, people realize that criteria they can let go. Not they necessarily will have to let it go, but again, it's like opening yourself up to what the future might bring.
Great advice. I think lots of people scrunching up that list this morning, Catherine, and throwing it in the bin. Thanks so much for joining us on the program this morning. That's Catherine Gray of Heavenly Partners. And if you want to get in touch, you want to learn more about getting relationships right from the start, or you just want to get more information about meeting someone who shares your faith, you can get in touch with Catherine, who we were just chatting to there at Heavenly Partners, on their Dublin number, which is 01531 4997, or indeed you can go onto their website, which is heavenlypartners.com. We've had a cold snap, now we're having a very wet snap of weather today, aren't we? So certainly I don't think I'll need to be watering my plants this evening, but what else do we need to do in terms of looking after our garden during this season? And also, there's so much significance when it comes to this time of year, Christmas, and plants that you mightn't be aware of. So we're going to be talking about that today with our next guest, who's with me in studio, Anne-Marie Baring for the Dalkey Garden School. Anne-Marie, good morning to you.
Hi, Wendy. Good morning.
So how's your garden doing? Wet this morning, of course.
Well, you're right. I won't be watering it. And actually, that's the point. When the ground is very, very, very wet, you should avoid walking on your garden, especially your lawn in areas like that, because the soil is very fragile and you can do a little bit of damage. But when it has stopped raining and it has dried out a little bit, it's a great opportunity to scarify your lawn, which means basically give it a heavy raking over so as to get rid of moss and thatch and things like that. And get it going open it up a little bit to allow the light in, so that in the spring it'll be a bit better. It'll grow a bit better. The other thing too is, this is an ideal time. Remember last summer it was very, very dry and a lot of the soil dried out very much. Soil being a lot of heavy clay in particular. So the best way to prevent that is to add on a heavy, heavy duty mulch. And what's the mulch? Mulch is organic matter, meaning it's stuff that's died down, shredded leaves. Compost, of course, is mulch. Farmyard manure is also a type of mulch. And it also acts as a blanket, but the soil is still quite warm. It's not as cold as it will be in February or March or even January. So it's an ideal time to put a good thick blanket of mulch on top of your soil to protect it from the wind, this heavy rain, number one. And number two, it insulates the heat a little bit. And also number three, during the summer, when the garden is very dry, it helps to retain moisture, which is very important. You could take cuttings of phlox or oriental poppies, the big blousy ones. Root cuttings are very interesting because you can take quite a few. You have to probably have to dig up part of the plant and actually take cuttings of that. Potted plants in your garden, for example, group them together for protection, because they will help each other keep a little bit warmer. Because obviously plots, if they get frozen, the pot can could expand and crack.
Do you take down all hanging baskets at this time?
Hanging baskets, yes. You're going to have winter flowering hanging baskets as well. But instead of having hanging baskets, put up, say, bird feeders, because we do need to help nature a little bit, because we have taken away a lot from them. So it is a good idea to help them. Dahlia tubers. Dahlias in my garden are still flowering. I haven't had a heavy frost. In a lot of places they've had heavy frosts, so they've died back. So you can do two things. You can either lift them, dry them out, make sure that they're quite dry in this, well, not bone dry in the sense, but dry like crumply, and then store them during the winter. And keep an eye on them during the winter so that they don't totally dry out.
Mary, what's your advice for? I'm sure you're very disciplined and vigilant now when
totally
it comes to your garden.
That's me.
When it comes to this time of year, I think I'm not alone in that when it starts getting dark at 4:30 and it's cold and it's rainy, the plants and the garden get neglected, and a few weeks go by and you think, whoops.
Well, what's your advice there?
Well, for example, you know, today is a very good example with a very, very heavy rain. Drains being blocked by leaves. So it is a really good example to remove leaves from your lawn when you have a chance. Okay, even though I said don't walk on it when it's very wet. But at the point, by removing the leaves, you're opening up the light to the ground. And you're also scarifying at the same time. The other thing too I would do is, if you have a chance, again, is go out and prune your fruit trees for shape. Now, the only trees that you shouldn't really prune this time of year are plums, cherries and other stone fruit trees, because they need to have a rising sap in order to protect them from open wounds. Now, what was your other thing today? What you could do in the dark days?
Yeah, well, obviously, if you've neglected your plants for a little bit and you're thinking, okay, I want to get back on track now. Revive them.
Well, one of the big problems we have is overwatering plants and obviously underwatering. This time of the year, hopefully we'll get some nice presents of some indoor flowering plants, such as amaryllis, which can be stunning. And if you look after them, you can have them flowering year in, year out. And there is a technique to doing that, which I'll put up on my website. So you have to look at my website to see that. And the other thing too, of course, is poinsettias are very, very, very popular. These are the lovely red, the
Where
red sort
of
bracts.
Where does that tradition come from? Because it's certainly a tradition in our house that both my mum and mummy-in-law have to get a poinsettia at the start of Advent.
I suppose it's because traditionally we have a lot of red and green and gold and silver as our the colour theme for Christmas. And I suppose maybe that's where it came from. Poinsettia are actually South American plants, and they were introduced from Mexico to the United States and they became very popular there. They're actually, I actually was very lucky enough to be in South America a couple of years ago, and I saw them, big bushes, big trees of them, which are extraordinary. And the ones we get for Christmas have been forced and brought on especially for the Christmas season. In order to look after them, when they dry out, wash them, but don't let them sit in water. Keep them away from drafts, and they do like a little bit of sunlight, but not bright sunlight. So they can continue on, and you'll have them growing. You can have them as a potted plant. Whereas quite often what happens is that we neglect them over the Christmas. They dry out and they're awful ugly and we just toss them. So it's an awful shame because a lot of effort and time is being spent to growing this plant. What else could you have? Cyclamen, indoor, beautiful. Now the big blousy ones are indoor plants. Don't be tempted to put them into your garden because once frost comes, they're gone. Whereas the smaller ones are the ones for outside and they give great colour in your garden.
What other plants, Anne-Marie, have kind of Christmas significance?
Well, holly, obviously. Laurel and ivy are the biggest ones. And holly, the prickly leaves represent the crown of thorns that Jesus wore. And of course, the berries is supposed to be the blood of Jesus. And in Scandinavia, it is known as the Christ thorn. Okay. Rosemary, which is a fantastic herb and grows very well in this country, is connected with Our Lady. And it was considered it was her favourite plant. And actually, I can't blame her. It's beautifully scented, fabulous in cooking, and has a lovely early flower.
Lovely on potatoes.
And lovely in potatoes. Oh, absolutely delicious in potatoes. And it's also known as the friendship plant. Laurel was the wreath symbolised success and victory for thousands of years. It also symbolises the victory of God over the devil. And of course, we could weave these into Christmas wreaths. And wreaths have huge significance to Christmas because we can have them indoors or outdoors, obviously. And you can make them from using, say, willow to use the frame. And then you can place it, obviously, laurel and holly and rosemary into them to highlight the significance. Ivy, of course, is a fantastic plant, and it was for decorating in Christmas and again on your wreaths. And ivy has to cling to something to support itself as it grows. And this reminds us that we need to cling to God to support our lives. And of course, the fantastic Jesse tree. Now, Jesse was the father of King David, and King David and Jesus was born into King David's family. So the Jesse tree is usually, it symbolises growth, because a new branch represents new growth. And I remember for the children's in Dorky, we used to have one up on the altar. We still have it on the altar at Christmas time. And I must say it was a huge, hugely fantastic thing to do. So even if you don't bother having a Christmas tree, have a Jesse tree. And we used to paint it white, and then we'd put all the symbols on it for Christmas. And
it's a lovely way,
magical
thing to do.
Traditions
going. The real
going.
Meaning of Christmas there, and to involve your children as well. I have to say, and just it's really interesting, just the history of some of those plants, and it strikes me lovely. Imagine you gave someone a rosemary, and then you're explaining that this is because it's friendship and stuff like that. Do you go for a real Christmas tree, Anne-Marie?
Oh, we do. I am. And some people might think, you know, a lot of I do, absolutely, because I love the smell of it. And then it's composted, it's shredded. I'm very fortunate. I live quite close to Killiney Hill, and there's a fantastic facility there to compost the trees. And the compost then is used in the woods for paths. And
so
that
it goes
sort of
back into the earth and keeps feeding some of the other trees that are there.
Yeah.
Well, I have a lot to think about and a lot to put in the wreaths. I love the idea of just knowing a little bit more about some of the plants and the idea of making a wreath and being able to then.
Yeah.
And I know that's something that you've got an upcoming workshop on, Christmas floral decorations.
I have. Yes, next Saturday. And Sally Horn is coming to do that. And the morning workshop is wreath making is full. And the afternoon one, we still have some spaces. But it'll be all about that, and which is really, really great fun. The other thing, too, I was going to say is that I'm starting gardening classes at the end of January in 6-week blocks. So if anybody's interested, they can contact me about the classes.
Fantastic.
And I also for Christmas ideas for presents, I'll shut up now, is, of course, I have vouchers. If anybody's interested.
Lovely. Well, give somebody the gift of green fingers, eh?
Absolutely.
And I really love the idea of being able to make a wreath or something for someone, and on the card you can explain all that's gone into it and their meaning. Yeah. I think it's just a lovely gift idea, taking away from all the commercialism of Christmas that people are sometimes caught up in. I've been chatting to Anne-Marie Baring, who's the founder of the Dalkey Garden School, and those workshops that Anne-Marie mentioned, you can go onto her website to get all the details, which is dalkeygardenschool.com. The report stage of the debate on the abortion bill is going to commence this evening. So what is going to happen next? Of course, we've had a lot of discussion just about the amendments that were proposed. Most of them, in fact, the vast majority of them, were not taken on board. So what happens next in relation to abortion legislation? Well, to help us with that, we've Eilish Mulroy, who's spokesperson for the Pro-Life campaign. Morning, Eilish. How are you?
Hi, Wendy. Thanks for having me on the programme.
So what stage are we at with abortion legislation, and what happens next? What does it mean in terms of when it's going to be passed? And is there any hope for proposed amendments, humane ones, like allowing pain relief for children who will feel pain during an abortion? Is there any hope that they will be included at all?
Okay. So first of all, as you correctly say, the report stage debate is commencing this evening in the Dáil, and that'll go on for the next 3 days, due to complete on Thursday. The bill was initiated at the end of September. It went into the Dáil for a second stage, and then it went to the Select Health Committee. And I think a lot of people would have heard in the media reports about the Select Health Committee discussions, because that's when some of the amendments you referenced were tabled and discussed by TDs from every side of the House, in fact. So the report stage debate will happen over the next few days, called stage three, and then it'll go to the Seanad and come back to the Dáil before Christmas. And Minister Harris has said repeatedly that he's very anxious, that he wants it all done and dusted, and he wants the abortion services rolling out in January. An indecent haste, we would suggest, in the pro-life movement. Just in relation to the amendments, there was a number of amendments introduced at committee stage. Most of them were refused. In fact, the amendments that were made at committee stage were really just technical changes, nothing of any consequence. We were very disappointed with that. And I think a lot of people, including people who voted yes on the 25th of May, would have been very surprised to realise that amendments providing babies with pain relief in late-term abortion, amendments seeking that babies born alive in the exceptional situation where a baby is born alive after abortion, that child would be given care and medical attention. It's quite shocking, in fact, that the Health Committee rejected those kind of amendments, and because I suppose that would be seen as a very humane thing to do.
And I think, Eilish, probably a lot of people, as they're listening to that, and even things like, you know, allowing abortion without parental consent, allowing abortion on the grounds of gender or if a child has a disability. Only yesterday I was chatting to a friend who was talking about being pregnant, and she said she was offered this blood test. I think it's called the Harmony test. She wasn't offered it the first time around. She said, oh yeah, I'm getting it because I'll be able to know the sex of the baby, and that's at 10 weeks. So there's probably, and that's kind of, I suppose, just shows you the advancement that's been made, but it could be used for, of course, something very, very negative if we're able to tell so early on that a child has a particular condition, or even, sadly, in some cases, as we've seen in other countries like the UK, abortion being carried out based on the child's gender.
That's right.
Do you think most people were aware of these elements of the legislation when they voted?
I absolutely not. And you mentioned the disability one. That's particularly interesting because, as you say, the Harmony test can detect conditions like Down syndrome from very early on. The minister himself, during the course of the debate, gave assurances on a number of occasions that abortion would not be permitted on the grounds of disability. Yet, in the bill, he has not precluded that. Now, that amendment was put forward at committee stage where TDs thought that an amendment precluding abortion on the grounds of disability or on the grounds of the gender of the child would be included. That was rejected. And that's totally shocking, considering that people would have voted on the 25th of May based on what they're hearing the minister say and based on assurances that the minister gave. The same thing happened, in fact, with the informed consent amendment, which the informed consent amendment sought to give ensure women would have all of the information they need prior to undergoing the abortion.
And you were kind of, those who were putting forward that amendment were accused of saying, look, you're just trying to upset a woman who's already in a difficult situation by trying to, for example, show her an ultrasound scan.
That's right. And the irony of that is, you know, some of those who were making accusations that the TDs bringing in those amendments were throwing around words like misogyny and paternalistic attitude, etc. I can't think of anything more misogynistic or paternalistic than depriving a woman of information. Because remember, the amendment offering in relation to an ultrasound was offering the woman a chance to see an ultrasound. What has happened to freedom of choice? So this is the irony of that. The same with the informed consent. We had one TD during the Health Committee hearing, during the Health Committee discussion, referring to the informed consent committee as, you know, trying to get a woman to look at propaganda. Now, how many women has he met in his life who've been through abortion, for whom that abortion has had a very negative impact on their lives, and their biggest regret is that this information wasn't given to them? Because if it had been given to them, they might not have chosen that path. And they're entitled to that information. So I think there's nothing more paternalistic in attitude than seeking to deprive women of information, as if they're not able to take on board that information, or they're too weak. And that's frightening that legislators would have that attitude. And that attitude has gone through the whole of the committee, the Health Committee hearings. And I'm hopeful that at a fourth stage, we see a little bit more engagement, a little bit less of the, you know, throwing around accusations, and a little bit more engagement in what these amendments are. Because we know, and the Pro-Life Campaign commissioned a MORIC research a number of months ago, we know that many, many yes voters would agree with these amendments. Yes voters believe a baby born alive after a failed abortion should be given medical attention. Yes voters believe that doctors and healthcare workers should not be forced to carry out abortions. That's not what they entered their profession for. They entered them to save lives, not end them. So we know that there is a lot of assent between yes voters and no voters on these amendments. They're very, very mainstream, middle ground and reasonable. And this legislation is absolutely barbaric. And I think people are beginning to realise that as it's being discussed more and more
then,
in the media.
What do you think then, Eilish, of just the, I mean, anybody who was able to look at just even snippets of the Oireachtas Health Committee hearings, certainly the tone was aggressive, is probably an understatement for those who are proposing some of these pro-life amendments. But as you say, I actually think it's unfair to say they're strictly pro-life, because I think a lot of people who voted yes would agree with them. And the attitude, Matty McGrath just described the attitude of Health Minister Simon Harris last week as just being incredibly condescending and smug. Do you think there's going to be an attitude shift at this stage of the discussions?
Well, I suppose at this stage you are in the chamber. It's a bigger situation. There's more people involved. The Health Committee is only a small group of seven or eight. Not many people actually engage with the Health Committee or watch the Health Committee discussions. I think what Matthew McGrath says is absolutely correct. There was an attitude, a nearly a sneering attitude adopted by the Minister for Health towards any of the amendments that he saw as being pro-life amendments, although, as you correctly say, they're very, very mainstream amendments. We'd be hopeful that things would be a little bit different. We'd be hopeful that Fianna Fáil TDs would get involved in the process and many of the Fianna Fáil TDs who are pro-life, who believe this legislation goes too far, that they would also speak to these amendments and defend them at a report stage. So hopefully the attitude will change and will be better.
Where is Fianna Fáil in all of this?
It's an interesting place. We know that a large number of the parliamentary parties were very supportive of the Eighth Amendment and campaigned against repeal of the Eighth Amendment. I think you'll have heard a lot of commentary around the fact that the people voted to repeal and therefore we shouldn't block the legislation. But that is absolutely not a correct reflection of what legislators should be doing. In fact, the referendum commissioner said very clearly that the people were voting to repeal the Eighth Amendment, but that legislators then had an opportunity and the responsibility to ensure that the legislation is good legislation. So Fianna Fáil TDs should be getting involved in the process. We're hopeful that they will be getting involved in the process over the next couple of days and really opening their minds to humane amendments to what is really a barbaric piece of legislation.
Finally, Eilish, just to ask you, for people who have been following this closely and they have concerns that these amendments aren't being heard, but maybe they feel a little bit despondent because of the attitude at the Health Committee, what can individuals do if they are concerned at this stage?
Well, what we've been asking our support base to do is to contact their TDs and ask their TDs to speak up at report stage starting this evening over the next few days, support good, reasonable amendments that have widespread support among the public, even among yes voters, and to do what they can to curb the excesses of this bill. Really, if this bill went through as is, it's probably one of the most extreme pieces of abortion legislation in the world. And that's not, I think, what the Irish people intended when they voted to repeal the Eighth Amendment on the 25th of May.
Eilish, thanks so much for joining us on the programme. That's Eilish Mulroy of the Pro-Life Campaign.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.